Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm David Ross, and welcome to episode 2 of The Sun's new podcast, Israel's War on Terror. This is a new program launched in the wake of Hamas's terror massacre in southern Israel on October the 7th. We'll aim to give you the latest on what's happening in the crisis, the context around it, as well as some in-depth analysis with experts and interviews with people directly affected. Well, arguably the biggest story relating to the conflict this week was the explosion at the Al-Ali Hospital in Gaza. In the immediate aftermath, some news organizations and social media commentators pointed the finger at Israel. Israel later insisted the cause was a misfired rocket launched from Gaza by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, a terror group affiliated with Hamas. Earlier, I spoke to military expert, former commander of British forces in Afghanistan, Colonel Richard Kemp, to ask him who he thought was to blame.
According to the IDF, the attack on the hospital was not by one of their weapons, despite earlier claims by people around the world that it was. Their evidence that they have produced, some of which shows that it was an Islamic Jihad terrorist rocket which fell short and landed on the hospital. The initial reactions were condemning Israel, automatically assuming Israel did it, without any evidence at all from anyone. Now the IDF have produced the evidence, which as far as I can see is pretty compelling. Obviously there is evidence and intelligence they've got that they haven't produced that they are going to share with their allies. In my experience, the IDF does not deny doing something of this sort if they do it. There have been incidents in the past where they've accidentally caused large numbers of civilian casualties. And in each case when that's happened, they have admitted and explained why it happened. So I don't think there's, in my opinion, there's no doubt that the IDF did not carry out this attack. And of course it plays right into Hamas and Islamic Jihad's hands by media, politicians, commentators, jumping straight to the conclusion and blaming Israel, because that's what Hamas wants. Hamas wanted Israel to be condemned for this. And it, as we've seen, it's already stirred up enormous amounts of public sentiment around the world, which is potentially dangerous as well. You know, I think media organizations that did jump straight to the conclusion and commentators would be better advised in future to be a bit more considered about what they say and to perhaps wait until facts do begin to emerge.
How realistic is it even that you can establish all of the facts in a situation like this just moments after an explosion occurs?
It's normally pretty difficult to establish the facts straight away. And those people who, the credible commentators and the credible media and the responsible media who have come straight to that conclusion that it was the IDF, should know that. I mean, it's their job to know that. It's one reason why the IDF took a bit of time. I think it was probably 2 hours, something like that, before the IDF said that it wasn't them that did it. Okay, there's a huge public interest in something like this, which is apparently a mass casualty event, although I wouldn't even trust the casualty figures produced by the Hamas medical the Gaza medical authorities, which are controlled by Hamas, and the figures they produce very often are false. They're very often exaggerated. They very often attribute to the IDF casualties that have been caused by their own people. So I think we ought to, if we're being responsible, we ought to address this in a much more sober fashion, because the last thing I'm sure that any media organization or any responsible commentator wants to do is to further inflame an already very, very dangerous conflict.
Just how irresponsible is it for media and commentators to immediately jump to a conclusion in such a situation?
I think it's deeply irresponsible of anybody to jump straight to a conclusion and then attribute the blame without knowing for sure, or as surely as they can know. Perhaps no one will ever know for sure exactly what happens in these conflict situations. But anyone who is interested in the truth needs to be much more considered about these things. Hamas wants Israel to be condemned, whatever happened, whether Israel did something, whether Israel didn't do it, they want Israel condemned. And so those media organizations and commentators who leap straight into the conviction that it was Israel responsible for this are playing straight into Hamas' hands, and they're actually making the conflict worse than it already is.
Let's move now to the actual war itself and where we are. How surprised are you that Israel haven't really begun a meaningful ground operation?
I'm not surprised that Israel's ground operations haven't begun. It was just over a week ago when the massacre occurred on the borders around Gaza in Israeli territory, and well over 1,000, 1,400, something like that, Israelis were murdered, raped, kidnapped, burnt alive in some cases. It was over a week ago, and it takes time to wind up a military machine to the extent that it can go in with great effect. Already, right from the early stages, the IDF were attacking from the air very effectively, and they've already, as far as I understand, killed a significant number of Hamas leaders and fighters. But it takes time to put everything in place for what's going to be a very, very challenging ground offensive. And then there are other factors to be considered. For example, what's happening in the north? On the northern border, the Israelis want to be sure, or as sure as they can be, about the likely expansion of the conflict up into the north. And we've already seen intensive fire from Hezbollah, more intensive attacks from Hezbollah than we've seen since the Second Lebanon War. Clearly, the Israelis need to know what they're facing before they launch the ground offensive and get completely locked into that. And the other factors to be considered as well are the weather, for example. And we've seen poor weather in Israel. We've seen about 3 days' worth of rain, not heavy rain, but rain that's sufficient to worsen or detract from, shall we say, the effectiveness of aerial surveillance and airstrikes, which, of course, the ground troops depend very heavily on. Now, I think it was known a couple of days ago that Biden was going to be coming to Israel. And I would imagine that, for political reasons, the Israelis might well consider that to launch an offensive during Biden's visit would not be the best thing to do. So it may be that that was another factor that played into the what seems to be a delay. The IDF will attack if they are going to attack on the ground. I would say if, because I don't think it's absolutely a foregone conclusion, but I think it's likely. But if they are going to go on the ground, they will go in at the time that's optimum for them. And bear in mind also that there's the issue of hostages, and I've no doubt enormous efforts are being taken now and have been taken since they were captured to try and find out where the hostages are and try and work out what they can do about them. If there's any chance of rescuing any of the hostages before a ground offensive occurs, or even in conjunction with a ground offensive, then the IDF will want to do that.
How concerned is Israel and the wider world that fighting could open up on more than one front?
I think it's very likely that we're going to see Israel facing a war on at least three fronts, and possibly four fronts. And that is, of course, Gaza. Secondly, Lebanon, where Hezbollah have a massive number of rockets pointed at Israel and have already started using. Thirdly, Syria, where there are various Iranian proxies which are being pushed forward and, in an attempt, I think, to maybe mount some form of attack from Syria, possibly even including the Syrian government authorities as well, who are under Iran's thumb to an extent. And then fourthly, in Judea and Samaria, otherwise known as the West Bank, where there's been extreme violence for a long period of time now, that could well trigger many more attacks on Israeli military and on Israeli civilians. So Israel might be fighting there as well, and possibly even inside Israel proper, where in the last conflict we saw an uprising among some Arab Israeli villages and towns against their neighbors. You know, what we should consider, I believe, is the extent to which this is an Iranian operational plan. Iran controls Hezbollah in the north. Iran strongly controls Hamas and Islamic State, Islamic Jihad, and they fund all three of those organizations. And Iran has significant influence in Syria that have been attempting for a long time to build a base of attack against Israel. And equally in the West Bank in Judea and Samaria, Iran has been funding and arming terrorists there to attack Israelis. Once Israel commits ground forces into Gaza, if it does that, then Iran might well then launch attacks from the north as well, and from Lebanon, and potentially also from Syria.
Colonel Richard Kemp there.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Hamas's October 7th massacre has set in motion a chain of events militarily and politically for which the endgame is unknown. As events play out on the battlefield, the personal tragedies continue. Those directly affected are trying to pick up the pieces of their lives. One person who had to do just that is British-Israeli rabbi Leo D. In April, his wife Lucy and daughters Maya and Rina were murdered by Hamas terrorists. I spoke to Rabbi D this week, who recapped on the events that shattered his world 6 months ago and his feelings on the more recent atrocities.
So we were driving up in two groups. My wife was with my daughters, Maya and Rina. I was with Tully and Yehuda. And my fifth child, Karen, was staying in Jerusalem for the weekend and going to join us later. As we were driving up, we got a message from my sister, who was in the third car, an hour behind us both. And she said there'd been a terror attack on the road. Were we okay? So I said, we were fine. And then I called Lucy immediately to find out how she was. I knew that we were neck and neck really on the journey, although she took a slightly different route at one point. And she didn't answer. So I called Maya and she didn't answer. I called Rina, she didn't answer. Then I looked on the Google Family link and I saw they were exactly at the location where this attack had occurred. So, of course, I immediately turned around. I started driving back down the road to that location. At the same time, my son, who is 14, has access to a website in Israel that gives the first information about any terror attack. And there was a photograph of a car, white car, with bullet holes in it. And on the back seat, you could clearly see the beach bag that they were taking up. And it was clearly our beach bag. So it was covered in blood. So clearly, we were in shock, but we drove down there. They wouldn't let us get close to the scene because they told us, psychologists, that it would be too traumatic. We sat there for probably felt like an hour, might have been, I don't know, for half an hour. And I was begging them to go to see, to be able to identify, to check that it was them, because I couldn't believe it. And eventually, they brought me the ID card of my daughter, Maya, and we knew that the worst had happened. They'd also told us that the woman who was driving had been airlifted to Jerusalem. Hospital. So we immediately did a U-turn and drove straight down to Jerusalem. We sat by our bed for the next couple of days. And sadly, Lucy passed away as well. And so we ended up having two funerals, the first one for my two daughters and the second one for my wife a couple of days later. And that was really, you know, that was a terrible disaster for us and tragedy. And the terrorists apparently were two Hamas terrorists funded by Iran who intercepted their car and shot them at close range with a Kalashnikov and 20 bullets. And my wife took one in her brainstem, one in her upper spine. And despite the operation, they weren't able to save her.
I can't imagine how difficult the last few months have been. But I imagine that on October the 7th, your emotions went through the rigor. Tell us exactly how you heard the news of what happened and what you felt as the horrors unfolded.
So, David, you know, it took place on Shabbat, but it was also a Jewish festival, which is called Simchat Torah. And the strange thing about Simchat Torah is that what we do on Simchat Torah is we finish every week in synagogue, we read a little part of the five books of Moses. But on Simchat Torah, we finish the end of it, the last bit of Deuteronomy, and then we start again from the beginning of Genesis. And so I had been to the service. We literally just finished reading the first bit of Genesis about the creation. And then the siren went off and men, women, and children and elderly were all, you know, running to the shelter. We get about a minute and a half because of the distance we are from Gaza. So we all hid in the shelter. Then once it stopped, we heard some, you know, a number of bangs. We went outside. We saw the missiles had been sent, but thank God had been exploded by the Iron Dome system. And then we went back into synagogue. And then we came back. Then we went home later when it finished. There were two more sirens. We have neighbors upstairs, so they basically joined us in our safe room because we share the same safe room. So we were four of us and a family of five from upstairs who were with small kids, all in one small room, my daughter's bedroom, which is the safe room. And that's how we spent the rest of the day. Then, of course, we didn't have a huge amount of information available to us because being the Sabbath and a festival, we didn't have our telephones at the ready. But what we did know was that our friends, you know, friends of our sons and friends would be called up and there were cars coming to pick them up to take them to the battlefronts. So we had some information about that. Then there was some mention about hostages being taken, but the whole thing was so surreal. It didn't make any sense to us whatsoever. We thought, you know, surely Israel has the safest border with Gaza. We have security, we have soldiers, we have intelligence. It's impossible that this could be, you know, what could be going on. No idea. And then, of course, we saw the news like everybody else once the Sabbath went out. And we were shocked and, you know, frightened, I think, really, that such thing had taken place, was continued to take place because there were still terrorists in Israel at that point, and nobody knew where they were. So everybody locked themselves up in their homes. And we waited for further information, which, of course, wasn't quickly forthcoming. So nobody really knew. It was complete confusion.
When you heard about the level of brutality in this particular attack and how heinous these terrorists have been, how much has your faith been tested, if it wasn't already tested?
So maybe because I'm a rabbi, maybe because I've been through this myself, I don't see it as a test of faith. A rabbi that I respected a lot in my youth was a Holocaust survivor, Rabbi Hugo Grin. And he was asked, you know, did the Holocaust, he was in Auschwitz, and did the Holocaust shake his faith in God? He said, no, it shook my faith in mankind, he said, because the evil was perpetrated by a number of PhD doctorates from Heidelberg University who attended the Final Solution discussions in Germany. And he said, you know, God, I don't blame, he said, but mankind and, you know, the sort of academic institutions which these people trained, I blame them. And I think the same thing here is that I don't lose faith in God in this situation. I perhaps question the culture which these people come from, the religion that they claim to practice and the culture in which they bring up their children. And that's the big question, I think, for all of us to ask at this point.
When your wife and two of your children were murdered, you didn't call out for vengeance. You were obviously aware that the IDF would have to investigate and respond. What's your feeling now in terms of how Israel should be responding to this wave of horrific terror?
So again, I don't feel anger, and it's not something which I generally feel, and I don't feel anger against any of these people at all. But I think that somebody put it very nicely and very accurately when they said that if Israel were to put down its weapons today, we would be attacked from our neighbors and we'd be slaughtered in our beds, as we have seen. If the Palestinians would put down their weapons today, we would have peace. And I think that is the reality. Unfortunately, we are surrounded by really a huge number of terrorists who want to see us dead. In the charter of the Gazan people, it's written that they have the intention of killing every Jew, not just in Israel, but all over the world. And unfortunately, that is the situation we're in. I think that many people in Israel understood this the last 20 or 30 years. We knew that the Palestinians, the Hamas, and the Palestinian Authority have been training their children from the age of 10 in terror camps, summer camps, where they, train them to be terrorists. We know that the textbooks that they learn from at school, which are paid for by the United Nations and published by the Palestinian Authority, contain comprehension stories about previous terrorists, asking them how they would, what they would do if they came to the beach in Tel Aviv with a gun, and they have to write a little creative story about that. And we know that there's been a massive program, what they call pay to slay, which means that the Palestinian Authority and Hamas pay terrorist families, if they've been neutralized after an attack, to the tune of maybe $1 million per family. So there's a huge financial incentive for these terrorists to perpetrate atrocities. It's the biggest incentive scheme for terrorists in the world, and it's right on the doorstep.
So how confident are you that further down the road that there is a chance for genuine peace?
I'm certain that there's a chance for genuine peace, and it really depends on the complete disarmament of the Palestinian people, not just in Gaza, but also in the Palestinian Authority, and a new structure, which is probably not a two-state solution, probably, as I say, more fragmented, but a state with an identity, with a flag, with its own culture, but perhaps not the ability to wage war on us in the way that it has been, by being contiguous. And therefore, for terrorists to hide behind human shields in quite the way that they've been able to up to now. And everyone in Israel knows people who have been either killed on the 7th of October or who were fighting on the front. And this is a national level tragedy. I mean, it's a Holocaust. And nobody in Israel expected that we would see in our lifetimes what our grandparents went through 80 years ago. And yet we're sitting here. Yeah, well, we've been saying never again for 80 years, and it just happened. So I think the desire on the behalf of the Jewish people and the Israeli people to make sure this really never happens again is now absolute. And I hope that the Israeli army takes this to completion and ensures that we have an outcome where this could never happen again.
Rabbi Leo D., whose wife and two of his children were murdered in April of this year. That brings an end to episode 2 of Israel's War on Terror. Please let us know in the comments if there are subjects you would like us to cover in the podcast, or if you have any questions, and we'll do our best to examine them in later episodes. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.